Welcome to Best of Artbeat, your weekly podcast celebrating the best of art and culture in Perth and beyond, hosted by Beck Bowman. YA author Astrid Schultz stops by to talk about her latest YA novel, League of Liars, which is out on bookshelves this month. During the episode, we are also joined by writer and performer Chris Isaacs, founding member of The Last Great Hunt, to talk about theatre and his latest projects. Plus, creative Bruno Booth discusses the excellent and insightful new exhibition at Goolagadup, which shares with generosity and vulnerability experiences of young people with disability.
You are listening to Artbeat on RTRFM 92.1. I'm Beck Bowman. We are going to be hearing very soon from Astrid Schultz. She is a young adult author who has written two books. One was so popular, Four Dead Queens, and she now has a new book, League of Liars, which is out on bookshelves this month. I caught up with her earlier this week to talk about pitch wars, social media, and big dreams of seeing her work on the screen. What was it that drew you to young adult fiction? Because personally, I think young adult fiction is just the best genre ever invented.
I have to agree.
There are people who are like, no, I'm not reading books for kids.
Yeah, and they're missing out on so much great fiction out there. I mean, it's a wonderful category. What really draws me towards it is it's what I love to read as well. So I read a lot of young adult fiction, in particular fantasy, which is what I write. And I find that in YA, you can break rules, blend genres, and you don't have to pick, you know, a certain lane. And when I was a teenager and I supposedly had to graduate out of teen fiction at the time it was called, YA wasn't really known as what it is known for today. And I didn't want to pick romance or science fiction or horror. I wanted a little bit of everything, and I think that's what YA can not only allow as a reader but also as an author. So I'm really drawn to being able to write the stories that I love to write.
Do you think that teen fiction as opposed to young adult fiction has been a change of losing perhaps that moralistic outview, that outlook that kind of really characterised, I guess, the late 90s writing for young people?
Definitely, yeah. There was always a lesson to be learned, and you definitely felt like it was an adult talking talking to a teenager. You didn't feel like you were on the same level or just being told a story. It felt a little bit distant. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing with YA in particular. It feels like the teenage characters, they have all this drive and they have these dreams and they're active characters in their lives. They're not having things happen to them and being told and taught lessons. So it definitely does feel different in the way that stories are told and the sort of stories that are told.
When it comes to your stories that you're telling, it's been this really interesting journey that's definitely embraced, I guess, social media and the online world. You first entered the competition Pitch Wars and then kind of built up this fan base over Twitter. How important is that fan base to getting a readership today?
I think it's not necessarily required, but it certainly helps. And I mean, I had been trying to get published and trying to get an agent for a few years before I got into Pitch Wars. And I think having that platform where I was having access to a broader array of people so that I could get my stories out there certainly helped. And that was ultimately what led me to getting my agent and then getting my book deal. So it's a different avenue to getting published. So it's not the only way, and it's, by no means you do have to be on social media, but it certainly helped in my journey.
It's interesting that you built this readership on Twitter, which I didn't, like, personally I don't associate with young adults.
Right.
So who do you think the people are that are following you? Are they older readers who really love young adult fiction? Are they other writers? Where are these users coming from?
Yeah, I definitely think it's a big part of the writing community. So that is aspiring authors and other published authors out there. And yeah, I would agree that it's not so much teenagers. There are a few, but it's certainly across the few years that I've been on Twitter, the landscape has very much changed. And I've been more active on Instagram for the last few years because I enjoy taking pictures. And then now it's shifted again to TikTok, which I can't quite wrap my head around.
That's okay. It's okay.
So, yeah, I think the teens are maybe not so much in Twitter and even less so maybe in Instagram. But, yeah, they're certainly still on social media and looking for books to read, which is great if you can manage to find them.
Yeah, it's amazing. League of Liars, published on the 1st of March. What can people expect from this story?
So League of Liars is a fantasy thriller, and it's set in a world where magic can be lured from any shadow to alter time. It's like a courtroom drama mixed in with the fantasy world, and it follows a 17-year-old legal apprentice who believes in the law above all else, and he starts to find his beliefs, he starts to question them as he is assisting on a case of three teenage criminals who have very interesting stories to tell, and their stories are not as black and white as he once thought they would be.
So do you think that because you did a lot of work in visual design or visual effects production, you've worked on like all these famous people's movies, James Cameron and Steven Spielberg, how do you think that working in visual effects has influenced the way that you tell story?
I don't really see them as two separate because they're both, you know, storytelling mediums, whether it's film and TV or whether it's books. And for me personally, I have to see a scene visually in my mind before I can write it down. So I kind of play it in my head like a movie and then try and transcribe it in the best way possible so that I can convey that to the reader. So it's definitely a big part of my writing process, and I want the world to feel immersive and real and give them that the reader that kind of experience as you might be if you were watching a movie or a TV show. So yeah, it definitely is a big part of my kind of cinematic type of storytelling.
When you say it's a cinematic type of storytelling, do you have secret ambitions for someone to buy the rights to your book and make a film? Like, is that kind of your secret desire?
I don't think it's so secret. I mean, I'm the first to put it out there and say I would love to see, you know, a Four Dead Queens TV show or a League of Liars TV show or the Vanishing Deep movie. I, yeah, have those desires and dreams. So hopefully one day they will come true. But, yeah, I think they could very well be a great adaptation on screen. I think they would look really exciting on screen, and that's, I try and write these worlds that do feel and look different. So yeah, that would be amazing if that happens one day.
Excellent. We're putting the word out now. If you are a filmmaker, please get in contact with Astrid. Or if you just like the sound of this book, League of Liars, it is from the same author as Four Dead Queens. That is Astrid Schultz. Astrid, it's been so lovely getting to know you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a great chat.
That was a chat I had with Astrid Schultz about her book, League of Liars. It's out now, and you can get it at all good bookstores. You are listening to Artbeat on RTR FM 92.1. I'm Beck Bowman, and I'm joined now by Chris Isaacs, who is going to be talking to us all about the 10-year anniversary of Dark Outside. It is a performance that was award-winning not only for its innovation, which is, you know, par for the course with Last Great Hunt, was also Helpman nominated, and we're going to celebrate all of that this year. Chris, please just explain the distinction between the show Dark Outside and Last Great Hunt.
Yeah, sure. Good morning.
So it's Dark Outside is a show that was made 10 years ago under the Perth Theatre Company banner by Tim Watts, Ariel Gray and myself. And we had been touring that show around for 2 or 3 years with Perth Theatre Company. And when Perth Theatre Company came to an end or a closure, it was at a very similar time to when The Last Great Hunt which involves Tim Ariel, myself, as well as other artists in Perth, Jeffrey J. Fowler, Adrian Daff, Gita Bazard, and Kat Osborne at the time, formed The Last Great Hunt. And because it was a show that we had the touring capacity for, The Last Great Hunt took on touring the show to continue its life around the world.
So even though it has a lot of ties to the kind of heritage of Last Great Hunt, we're not technically celebrating 10 years of Last Great Hunt.
No, so The Last Great Hunt's 6 years old as a company. Yeah, we're celebrating.
It's still pretty good.
Oh, it's amazing. And we've been real lucky we've just had such a really good 6 years. But we're also very lucky because as three artists who made this show, we were supported by a funded company 10 years ago in Perth Theatre Company, and the artistic director, Mel Cantwell, at the time, gave us a lot of opportunity and a lot of space to create this work. And I think it continuing on is a legacy of when theatre companies invest in young artists and give them space.
There's definitely a focus now on, like, not so much theatre companies investing in young artists and giving them space to work, but this maybe hustle culture of, you know, if you're graduating from somewhere as an actor, make your own work. Make your own things happen. And that's a lot of pressure sometimes for young people.
Yes, it can be. And to talk about the environment of making work in Perth at the moment, there's a lot less opportunities now than there were when I was making work at a younger age. And the people I collaborate with now, all of the members of The Last Great Hunt, we all talk about the opportunities that we had that don't exist anymore. And that's just as simple as venue spaces, the pricing of venue spaces, the amount of sort of one-off performance grants that existed for us back then, the youth theatre grants that existed for us back then that don't exist now. So it's harder because of less opportunities. But I think Perth has always had a very good culture of theatre making and a very good culture of you can't just be a single thing in the arts community. You kind of have to be able to spread yourself across many different components of theatre.
When I think that's one of the things that I've really liked seeing in Last Great Hunt is you definitely have a dedication to providing opportunities and welcoming new people into your crew.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's something that we feel very strongly about. And I think it's because we recognise that when people did that for us, when we were developing our craft, we ended up with shows that allowed us to travel the world, like It's Dark Outside. And I think a part of our responsibility as a company who does get funding from our state government is to make sure that we're servicing not just the audiences, but the theatre community that we're working within.
Yeah, for sure. And kind of giving back to those.
You it's know? Also like, it's also really fun because, like, the youth that are coming through and the younger people making theatre at the moment in Perth are doing some... They're just so exciting. There's some really exciting stuff happening. And I kind of like, as artists, we want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And so the way that... We don't want to go stale and old. So we're trying to kind of like co-opt them and say, hey, come work with us because we want your great ideas and we want to learn from you as much as we can teach you.
Please, I want to stay relevant.
Yeah, I want to stay relevant.
Come here.
I can feel it ticking away.
Please don't. I'm struggling with that this week. So Dark Outside... Why are we bringing this particular show back? What is so great about Dark Outside that people should be given another opportunity to see it 10 years on?
Yeah, well, the 10-year anniversary is a great excuse to bring it back. We haven't performed it that many times in Perth. It had its original season, and I think then there was maybe one or two one-off shows before we've toured it out at different points over the 10 years. It's been performed around Western Australia with some regional touring, but the only time it's had a sustained season in Perth was its debut season. And it was a show that a lot of people spoke about it had a lot of good memories around it, and it felt like the right time to bring it back for new audiences and as well as celebrating the 10 years, but have it there so those who haven't seen it or didn't get a chance to see it 10 years ago can see this show. And it still holds relevance it's timeless in a lot of ways because of its theme and stories. It's about an old man wandering off, chasing his past that seems to evade him. And it's about loss and grief and the beautiful lives we live and the memories and support. And I think that has a timelessness and a warmth to it.
Oh, absolutely.
That is a sort of a thing maybe that we respond to quite a lot at the moment in the world.
I think, you know, I think there is a softness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very tender show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So make sure you take some tissues with you. I think it's definitely like this amazing opportunity to see works that, because a lot of the time theatre can be very ephemeral, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we stage these works and they are amazing and everyone kind of raves about them for a few months, and then where do they go? And so I think being able to bring something back from 10 years ago and, you know, who knows, hopefully bring it back again in 10 years' time and just have this as part of our kind of collective memories is a beautiful idea.
Yeah, I think that would be really lovely. And I do think that there is a reality that a lot of theatre disappears quite quickly, but then some legacy pieces sort of remain and sustain. Mm. Like Cloud Street, for example, that was on two years ago.
Yeah.
Like that's just, it seems to be a legacy piece. And I know it was a new production, but it's this thing that exists in the consciousness of theatre in WA. And it's nice to have a show that can sustain 10 years and be done for 10 years, but also, gee, to bring it back home, it's a special thing. It's a pretty special feeling.
What do you hope to see Last Great Hunt be in 10 years' time from now?
Oh, gosh. I hope that we haven't gotten to a point where we've lost what I think makes us a pretty special company at the moment, which is that the philosophy of give artists time, give artists space, let ideas develop.
Mm.
I think having a lot more outreach programs or development programs would be really good, something to be able to kind of support better the sort of training and initiatives that we want to give back to our community in the theatre arts, but also our community abroad. It'd be nice to have a few shows kind of in the touring wagon again. That's been on hold for 2 years, obviously. Mm. And I think making new creative, inventive work. There's some talk amongst the company around different mediums, so
yeah,
maybe
cool.
Not just theatre, engaging in different things. And perhaps building the family of the company as well. Like as we get bigger, as the workload gets bigger, we've got some incredible staff working for us, and you know, being able to support them better would be a really nice thing.
Fantastic. So many plans that you get to bring to fruition.
Yeah. We'll call them dreams.
That is Chris Isaacs talking about The Last Great Hunt, which is 6 years old. The award-winning Dark Outside, however, is 10 years old this year. And you can see that again. When is opening night?
It's on the 16th of March. It's it starts next week and it runs until the 2nd of April.
Excellent. Plenty of time to go and catch that.
I should say, though, that because of the COVID restrictions, it's a reduced house seating. So if you do want to get it, I recommend booking in.
Get in.
Because if it gets reduced even more, which it's a reality, it'll be a first in, best serves or first served sort of scenario. So get on the tickets and book in if you want to see it.
Yeah, for sure. Chris, thank you so much for coming in and having a chat. It's been lovely.
Thanks, Beck.
All the best. So Bruno Booth has come along to talk to us about his new exhibition at Goolagadup Heathcote. Body Shots is a solo exhibition that considers representation and identity of people with a disability. This is a subject matter that Bruno has explored before in terms of how we navigate the world and how that is different for someone in a disabled body. Bruno, welcome.
Thanks, Beck. Nice to talk to you again.
It seems you
like
too.
Only yesterday we were sort of chatting.
I know.
It's been a minute. Yeah.
It's just time is going so fast and so slow at the same time. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
This new exhibition, Body Shots, it's a 9-channel video installation and there's an accompanying soundscape, right?
Yeah.
So that's a very ambitious kind of undertaking. How long have you been working on this?
So I've kind of been working on and off on this project for the past, like, I guess 6 months, but it was only in the past couple of months that I really sort of dug into it and started to finalize things. Like, The videos are all like shots of my body in sort of like real close up, so real sort of macro style in sort of different locations. So there was a bit of travel involved in making the work as well, local travel, obviously. But that was fun, just like to go to sort of lots of weird locations and take my clothes off and film myself. It prompted lots of strange interactions with like members of the public as well, which was fun.
I was going to say, I'm sure that would have given a few people cause to pause and try and figure out what's going on. When you do interact with people, like as you're making your work, like does that become an extension of your creative practice almost?
It definitely does, because the soundtrack that sort of accompanies the work is something that I've made myself, because I used to make a lot of music. So I was like, well, I want to sort of utilize those skills and make something that goes along with it. And what I did was, when I was recording, because I shot all this footage on my phone, because, you know, phones are great now and they can shoot 4K and it's looks brilliant if you're outside in natural light. And so as a result of shooting on my phone, I picked up all these sort of conversations that I was having with people, and little interactions and stuff. And a lot of those are mixed into this soundscape that accompanies it. I mean, I've distorted a lot of it, and I've used delay and reverb and like looping and things like that. So you can make out a few sort of words, but I didn't want it to be about those conversations. I just wanted to have them as this sort of underlying, undulating background, I guess, to the work.
And so what is it that you're foregrounding in the work?
So it's I mean, like, it's a bit narcissistic, I guess. It's all about...
You're like, this is about my body.
Yeah, this is about my body. I mean, like, so having, like, a physical disability, often people feel like they've got permission to come up to me, like strangers in the street, and just, like, ask me what happened, you know, like, and they need to know. They need to know right then and there, like, what happened. And, like, I'm quite comfortable to talk about those sorts of things, because I've always had this body. But, I mean, if they... We're approaching someone who's had some sort of traumatic event in their life, you know, that's like, it's a bit weird that people think that they can do that. And I think part of the reason that they're doing that is obviously just genuine interest. But then there's also part of it that doesn't see the person, they just see the difference, you know. So making this work and like showing my differences in like high definition, it's sort of allowing people permission to see, but it's sort of on my terms as well. I get to show them. And, like, you never see a complete shot of my body or even parts of my body. So I was talking to a guy yesterday who works at the gallery at Gula Gadup, and he was saying it was cool how he couldn't really work out which bits were which in some of the shots. And that's kind of what I was going for, you know, like that sort of like an air of mystery. So you get to see, but you don't get to see everything.
And is that kind of protective for you? Because it feels like what you're saying is that a lot of people feel that they have a kind of right to or an ownership of your body.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit of a like a protection strategy, I guess. Like I am becoming more and more comfortable, like showing my body, but there's still a bit of hesitancy there, just because sometimes you just want to disappear into the background. And I think, and I've mentioned this before, it's like very hard to disappear into the background if you have a disability, because even when people are ignoring you or like crossing the street almost, they're still looking and they're still aware, and you're aware of those gazes as well. And so the way I've set up this installation, I'm using like a lot of little microcomputers that are showing the footage on this loop, and they have got these blinking red lights, and they're attached to this black frame, and it almost looks like when you're looking, you're being observed by some sort of security, like surveillance sort of footage. That was kind of unintended. It just sort of happened as I was building the installation, but I think it sort of really enforces the ideas that I want to explore a bit more as well. I've got, had so many ideas from making this work. It's great.
Through making this work, like this, has this work generated more ideas for you to keep?
Yeah, cool.
Like, so tell us what's going to be happening next then. Like, what can we expect from you next? Do you make something and then go, right, I need to do something else?
Well, I mean, like, yeah, because I've got a bunch of shows this year that I'm starting to make work for. Like, I've got a show at Seventh Gallery in Melbourne in June, which I now know is going to be video and sort of sculptural work, sort of springboarding off what I've done for this. And then I'm in the Stringer Prize as well, which is like a the John Stringer Prize, which is like a invitation prize for WA artists. There's six of us in that show, and I'm definitely
some amazing artists in that show.
Yeah, like Guy Larden, who works at Glagada, like mm-hmm. I mentioned, Holly Ishida,
Amanda Bell,
Jackie Cheng. I think that's everybody.
Apologize to who we left out. I'm going to double check that, make sure we didn't leave anyone out.
Yeah. And then this show for Gulagadda Body Shots is going to go to Tasmania at the end of the year as well for a show at Gallery Plimsoll, which is attached to the university there as well. And I'm hoping it's going to tour off the back of that, because the curator is trying to make this exhibition tour, this group show. And I think that's featuring works by Amrita Heppy as well, and a bunch of other like great Australian artists. So it's a real sort of feather in my cap to be part of that.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you, Beck. Yeah.
Bruno, as always, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Tonight is going to be a great night because it's also Gulagadup Sounds,
yeah,
which means there's music for people to enjoy.
Curated by Lyndon Blue, who's an amazing local musician as well, which you probably know him.
It's always nice to have other people compliment you. And live music from Seven, so Honor Culture and Esfandia Buria Ensemble. And there's also an opening from Elsa Waddle.
Yeah, who's a great young artist. I know Elsa because they work at Pika with me as well on the install team. And I've had a sneak preview. I've looked into the room and it is beautiful. It's amazing.
So definitely get on down to Gulagadup
Heathcote. Yeah.
Check out Bruno's work. Check out Elsa's work. Have yourself some enjoyable times tonight. And when does the exhibition close?
It closes, I think,
24th of April.
Of April. Yeah, you know.
So 24th of April, you've got a few weeks to get down and check it out.
You've been listening to Artbeat. Make sure you restream the episode in full on our website or tune in next week at RTRFM 92.1.